From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Black Sunday, as it came to be known, was a turning point in the war in Iraq. On April 4, 2004, American soldiers who thought they were on a peacekeeping mission in Sadr City were ambushed. They realized they were now facing an insurgency. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with ABC Chief White House Correspondent Martha Raddatz. She's reconstructed the battle in Sadr City in her book, The Long Road Home. She's been to Iraq 12 times since the war started. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. died last night at the age of 89. He was an advisor to President Kennedy. We'll listen back to an excerpt of an interview we recorded on the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Martha Raddatz, is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and formerly served as ABC's senior national security correspondent. Before joining that network, she was the Pentagon correspondent for NPR. She's been to Iraq 12 times since the start of the war. Raddatz's new book, The Long Road Home, reconstructs the battle in Sadr City. It began in April 2004 on what's come to be known as Black Sunday, when the 1st Cavalry faced Iraqi insurgents and had more casualties than any single day since Vietnam. Her book is based on interviews with the American soldiers who were ambushed by insurgents. She also interviewed their families back home about what it was like when they got news of the battle. Martha Raddatz, welcome to Fresh Air. Why is this battle considered a turning point in the war in Iraq?
I think it's the first time that the U.S. military realized there are people here who don't like us. There had been sporadic and very violent attacks, a few of them. There had been a few suicide car bombings before that, but never such a wholesale assault on the U.S. military, and particularly in an area where the U.S. military thought they liked us. This was Sadr City. This had been under the thumb of Saddam Hussein for so long that the military and civilians assumed that everyone would greet the military with open arms. It's a thing you've heard over and over again. But this city, this slum, personified that because they felt that they would believe that the U.S. military would come in there as saviors. And that day, it was clear they were not.
What did they face? What did the platoon face in Sadr City that made them realize this was an insurgency?
Well, it all started out very quietly. They'd been patrolling. It was a morning where they'd done sewage patrols, honey trucks, as they call them. The Iraqis would drive around and suck up sewage. There's more sewage, raw sewage, in the city than you can imagine. And they had been escorting these trucks, and they realized, first of all, that the truck drivers, the Iraqi truck drivers, were starting to get taunted by some of the people on the street for even being with the Americans, and they didn't think much of that. And then, really just very suddenly, they started being fired upon, and it grew in intensity, and there were RPGs flying, this platoon, 19 soldiers out there, and an Iraqi interpreter were under fire, pinned down. They were in four Humvees. Two of those were completely disabled and burning, and the crowds grew. It wasn't just the Mahdi militia, Muqtada al-Sadr's army. It was civilians. There were women. There were children. It grew from hundreds to thousands of people on the street, and every rescue attempt, there were more and more people attacking those rescue squads.
The soldiers thought this was going to be a peacekeeping mission. They thought it was a kind of routine patrol. How were they unequipped for the insurgency that they faced?
They were equipped for a peacekeeping mission. The Army, the Pentagon, decided that it would be bad to bring in a whole lot of tanks, a whole lot of Bradleys, because then you look like an occupier. Those are very bad in such a dense urban environment. And if you open fire, you're bound to have what they always call collateral damage, which means you can kill a lot of innocent people. So when this platoon came under assault, when these men were out there, they were in unarmored Humvees. Some of them just had canvas tops, and they were in open trucks. It's really extraordinary when I see these trucks. In fact, when I was just back there a couple of weeks ago, I saw one of them. They're called LMTVs, and they're basically supply trucks, carry troops around, but they are wide open. It is like a giant pickup truck. And these soldiers hopped into these trucks to try and rescue this platoon in this wide open truck.
So what were the Mahdi militias' tactics in fighting the American military during this battle in Sadr City?
I think the oldest tactics that these soldiers, and some of them were sitting in their vehicles thinking, oh no, I've read about this. I've seen this in the movies. This is horrible. The tactics were often to put children out in front. There was a point when these soldiers were in this alley. They'd been pinned down for about an hour. They'd taken refuge in this alley. And on either side of this alley, and it was about 10 feet wide, lots of small concrete houses, and they'd taken refuge in one of the houses with Humvees parked in the alley. On either end of that alley, They saw hundreds of Mahdi militia and civilians lining up, and they would line up in tiers. And in the very front, they had children. Behind them, they had old people. Behind them, they had teenagers. And behind them, they had the Mahdi militia. And the Mahdi militia were firing over the heads of the children as they approached further and further down the alley. And Lieutenant Shane Awero, who was the platoon leader, watched them. And he, in his mind, calculated at what point his men had to open fire no matter what. And because he felt they'd be overrun. And he watched those children. He has children of his own. Most of the men looked at the children aghast, but at some point they just started firing. They had to, because the Mahdi militia was firing at them. And the descriptions of what happened in that alley and what was left in that alley are horrifying.
Tell us a little bit about what did happen.
There were, Lieutenant Awero told me, probably 100 bodies on either end of the alley, piled on one another. Piles of shoes, piles of clothing, a bloodbath in that alley. And Lieutenant Awero and some of the other soldiers just said, in their minds, it was kill or be killed at that point. Again, horrified that they had to shoot children. But at the same time, they knew those were the tactics that often the Mahdi militia or other insurgents had used over the years. There was another tactic that some of the insurgents had used. And, you know, Terry, I find myself in the same problem here, what to call the enemy in Iraq, since it's changed so many times, but we'll call them insurgents at this point. And they would put a gun out. They would put an AK-47 out on a string, and they would pull the gun back to themselves, grab the gun, run out into the alley and shoot at the soldiers. Or they would get children to stand out in the alley and point out where the soldiers were firing from. They call those kids peekers. And they started saying there's a peeker over there, because the little kids would run around the corner and point at the soldiers. They did not shoot those children because they were not armed. But they would, if the insurgent would come around the corner, the Mahdi militia would come around the corner and fire, then the child would usually run back.
So those AK-47s on a string, was that meant to be a decoy to, like, deflect attention to the wrong spot while real action was going to come from someplace else?
Actually, there was probably that, but it was also a way, if the shooter was killed, they'd still have the weapon, and that they could pull the weapon back.
Another tactic the Mahdi militia used, which isn't as horrifying in the sense that it didn't take advantage of children, it didn't abuse children for this, but they would haul objects into the intersections. And talk a little bit about this tactic.
Well, that was what was astonishing. And I've driven down these streets in Sadr City so many times, and there are usually these lively markets, and they're selling vegetables and fruits, they're selling hubcaps, they're selling almost anything you could possibly think that any human being could sell. You have to imagine this too, because it's absolutely lined with sewage. And I mean, you can smell this city from miles and miles away because of the raw sewage, but the markets are out there. The day of this battle, the day of this ambush, the entire town shoved everything into the road as an obstacle course. It was a flaming obstacle course within about 20 minutes after this platoon was pinned down. They had piles of hot dog stands and what looked like hot dog stands, big metal stands that we can identify from streets of big cities. They had kitchen sinks. At one point, they had a giant metal staircase blocking one of the routes. And basically what this did was block off any kind of rescue, because they would have these main routes on the streets blocked with all of this mess that they'd pull down from the markets.
How did this battle in Sadr City finally end?
The real battle there didn't end for 80 days, because at the same time that they pinned down this platoon, they took over, the Mahdi militia took over every police station in the city. So as soon as they were finished rescuing this platoon, and they lost 8 soldiers that night, and they had more than 70 wounded, as soon as they managed to get that platoon out of there, they had to go try to reoccupy the police stations, take that back from the Mahdi militia. But 80 straight days, They fought to get those police stations back, to get the city under control. They got it under control for about a month, and violence broke out once again, and they fought for another 60 days. And look where we are today in Sadr City. It is a long way from being solved.
What is it like now in Sadr City?
You can't go in. I was there 2 weeks ago, and it's the first time. I mean, think about this and how long we've been there, or how long ago this battle was. It was not safe for anybody to go in. The military wouldn't take us in, and it is such a political firestorm there right now, as you probably know, that the Maliki government has been accused of being in bed with Muqtada al-Sadr. He is now in the political arena, but he controls that town without question.
Al-Sadr controls the town?
Al-Sadr controls that town without question. The last time I went into Sadr City in August of last year, you could see Mahdi militia members along the street still toting AK-47s. We went in there very quickly and got out of there quickly. I went back to see the alley again, which is a place I like to see to sort of get a feel for what's going on in Iraq, is to return to that alley as often as possible. But this time there was no chance we could go in there.
My guest is Martha Raddatz, ABC's chief White House correspondent. Her new book about the battle in Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Martha Raddatz, and she's the White House correspondent for ABC News and their former senior national security correspondent, also former NPR Pentagon correspondent. She's been to Iraq 12 times since 2003. Her new book, The Long Road Home, is about the battle in Sadr City that was a turning point in the war in Iraq, because it was the first sign that there was a major insurgency against American troops. The book is called The Long Road Home. Did the families at home hear about the battle first through cable news or through calls from the military?
The families, there's something called a family readiness group. In the family readiness group, the brigade commander's wife, the battalion commander's wife, Leanne Valesky, and Connie Abrams both first started hearing about the battle from calls from Baghdad. They didn't know who had been killed, and it came as 2 dead, 4 dead. Get the care teams ready, who would go out and help take care of the families. But the notification comes from the knock on the door. The notification always comes from the knock on the door. People had probably started hearing a few things about a battle in Sadr City. I know Cindy Sheehan heard about the battle in Sadr City, and she immediately said, "Casey's dead." And her husband said, no, there are 160,000 troops over there. There's no way he's dead." And by the time the notification teams got to her, she was convinced that he wasn't. But when the knock on the door came, that's how they do it. They only do it before 10 p.m. and after 6 a.m. They won't do it in the middle of the night. And the reason they don't do that is they don't want military families to go to bed thinking they could get a knock on the door in the middle of the night, because they know no one would ever be able to sleep.
Colonel Abrams, who commanded the division's 1st Brigade in Sadr City, was the son of General Creighton Abrams, who was in Vietnam, and the Abrams tank is named after him. But although Colonel Abrams had been in the military for about 22 years, until Sadr City, you say he'd never heard a gun fired in battle. How has he changed? You know, this person of from an illustrious military background, how has he changed by actually being in battle?
Colonel Abrams, who I describe as his soldiers joke that he's a natural-born killer, given his family history, is the most straight-ahead, salute, sir, colonel you've ever met. Always the colonel. He's a wonderful, warm guy, but he is very military. I talked to Colonel Abrams in Sauter City. They were just about to go back home, and he was, you know, ramrod straight posture in his uniform and practically saluting me. And I asked him a very simple question. I said, tell me what your year has been like. And the division by the end of the year had lost 168 soldiers, either in battle or through accidents. And Colonel Abrams started talking, you know, very clipped sentences, and then he said, it's been hard on our families, and he could not continue. He burst into tears. And he was so upset by this that as soon as we finished, he was calling me saying, I can't believe I did that. I'm totally humiliated. You're not going to use that, are you? And I said, Colonel Abrams, it is a lovely, lovely tribute to your family and to the military. And yes, I am going to use it. And I promise you it'll be used tastefully. And he later that evening emailed General Peter Corelli, who was the division commander who was in Baghdad. They're all in Baghdad still, and I am too. And General Corelli did one of those great things, which is he forwarded me this email, unbeknownst to Colonel Abrams, who we both told. And the email said, General Corelli, I try to make the division proud, but today I let you all down. I was interviewed and got emotional when talking about our families. I'm sorry to let you down, sir. And General Corelli wrote back and said, you would have let us down if you'd done anything else. So to me, to see how heartfelt and how much pain these soldiers have from this and their families, but that they go back and do it the next day. I mean, the next day, they were fighting for 80 straight days. And the 1st Cavalry Division is back in Iraq now.
Why did you use that scene of Colonel Abrams breaking down and talking about what his family had been through? Why did you use it after he asked you not to?
He never frankly said, don't use this, you can't use this. But I think he understood how powerful it was too. I think it's good for Americans to see that our military has heart, has suffered in this battle, gets up every day and does it again. I mean, to me, when I see someone like Colonel Abrams and I see the pain, the depth of pain, it is remarkable to me that people don't understand or that none of us have paid enough attention to this conflict. I went through a period where I would tell people, please, please, just when you read the paper, read the names of the dead. Do that. It's the least you can do. None of us have paid any price for this war outside of those who have family members there or who have served. None of us. Yeah, people can put up a yellow ribbon, but you still go shopping every day, you still go out to dinner, you still mow your lawn, and you don't think about it. There is the greatest diversity in the military community and in their families. You can't imagine it. Their families, they're like us, but they have experiences unlike those we will ever have. And it is important for us to connect with them, to somehow know what they're going through, and not just say, aren't they great, as if they're our, you know, hometown football team, and go on and do whatever we do.
As the White House correspondent for ABC News, what's it like for you to hear often pretty upbeat press briefings from the White House about how we're doing in Iraq and what the outcome is going to be, when you've been there and you've seen and heard really gruesome things? You can't even get into Sauter City right now. Is there often a real disconnect between the briefings that you get and what you see when you're in Iraq?
Oh, is there ever? And believe me, it can drive me crazy. And there have been a couple of times when I've just been back. And in fact, the president had a briefing just a couple of days after I got back from my last trip. And he knows I go. He asks me about the trips. He's pretty respectful of it. And he also knows I know what's going on there. And I think it is an advantage for me because they know I know. I feel like I can ask better questions at some of the briefings, but here's the problem. It doesn't mean you get better answers. And I think the press corps in general is getting far more aggressive about saying, wait a minute, that's not really what's happening. I mean, I remember the day that they came out and glowingly said they're going to start all these provincial reconstruction teams around the country and they're going to double the size, and asking, well, wait a minute, they can't even staff the ones they've got. They're not working. You've got a few people, you've got some unqualified people, the military is filling all the bills because you can't get civilians from the State Department to go over there. How on earth are you going to double the size? And it was just sort of, oh, we are. I mean, I know. I've been there. I've seen it. It is actually disturbing to me. When I first started covering the White House and I first started hearing this, I thought, this is difficult. This is really difficult because I know what's going on. Now, I've also listened for years and through years of Rumsfeld saying it was the media's fault and we're not reporting the good news. I mean, the truth is, we're there. We are covering that story because the U.S. military is still there after 4 years and because it is still not under control. I mean, I heard General Casey say in one of his last hearings, Americans would not be safe walking around 50% of that country. And that's very true. It might be more than that.
Martha Raddatz is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News. Her new book about the battle in Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Adopted Son, a story of Washington, Lafayette, and the friendship that saved the Revolution by David A. Clary. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. died last night at the age of 89. He was an advisor to President Kennedy. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Schlesinger about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we talk with Martha Raddatz about covering the White House for ABC News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Martha Raddatz, ABC's chief White House correspondent and former national security correspondent. Before joining ABC, she was NPR's Pentagon correspondent. Her new book, The Long Road Home, reconstructs the battle in Sadr City when the American military realized it was facing a major insurgency in Iraq. She's been to Iraq 12 times since the start of the war. When we left off, we were talking about covering White House briefings in which the information given to the press has sometimes conflicted with what she's observed in Iraq. You know, most of these press briefings are shown on C-SPAN and some of them on CNN. You see clips of it on the evening news. Do you feel like your pointed questions are, in a way, a method of registering protest or offering alternate information in a public setting, in addition to just asking a question?
That's really an interesting thing, because I do. I mean, I think you, and I hadn't thought about it quite that way. I think you know you're on the record. This is history. As much as some of those briefings can just be, you know, whatever, they can be performances, they can be spin, they can be whatever, you do want to get on the record and say, well, wait a minute, I know this, that, and the other happened, or and it's true. I mean, the way you frame the questions, you know that you are adding something, hopefully.
What is the question you're most glad you asked, because it got you on the record as registering something contradictory to what you were officially being told?
Well, I remember one exchange with the president, and this was months before he announced his new strategy. And I said, Mr. President, is it, I named some statistics about what was happening over there, and, you know, this is going bad and that is going bad. Is it time to look for a new strategy? And at that point, he turned and he said, well, I talk to my generals about tactics all the time. And I said, I didn't say tactics, I said strategy. And he flashed me what I thought was a look of the teacher trying to put the child back in his place. And he said, well, like I said, you know, I'm trying to quote the president, but I can't really. But it was the strategy tactics thing back and forth. At the last press briefing, I asked the president whether he agreed with his national intelligence estimate that it was a civil war. He didn't answer that. He actually said, it's hard for me to say, living in this big, beautiful White House, you've been there, I haven't, which was a strange answer, to say the least. First of all, he has been there a couple of times, but he is the president, and Tony Snow will tell us every day he has more information about Iraq than anyone.
Do you have to worry about the possibility of a critical report or a critical question resulting in your access to the White House being cut off?
I don't think so. There is always, whenever you cover a big, important building, there is always, you're always going to get a call from somebody if they don't like your report. If my report is accurate, I have no problem with it. My organization would back me hands down. I don't worry about it. I will not let myself worry about that. Mm-hmm. The questions especially, I think the White House is very good at not worrying about what the questions are. In fact, it's a whole lot more pleasant covering the White House in those briefings than it ever was covering Don Rumsfeld.
What is the difference? What was the difference like between covering the Pentagon under Rumsfeld and covering the president, you know, President Bush's White House?
I thought Secretary Rumsfeld could be incredibly disrespectful of the questioners. And, I mean, didn't listen, it was... The atmosphere in there was not good. And I think he generally just didn't like the press, just didn't want to deal with the media, saw us all the same, all bad, never really engaged with anyone, never really talked to anyone at any length. At the White House, at least, I think, you know, you can ask Tony Snow anything you want. You know, you can tell him his mother wears army boots and he's not going to get mad at you. Now, again, like, neither one of them really answered much, but it's a more respectful attitude in the White House, and that may well be just because they know they have to deal with the press every day and that everybody's watching in a way that they probably weren't watching with Don Rumsfeld. But he was very, very difficult to deal with. And I know he thought of himself as incredibly accessible and providing more information. I found the Pentagon under Secretary Rumsfeld, and I'd been covering it a long time, provided less information than any Secretary of Defense who I'd ever covered.
I don't know if you read Seymour Hersh's piece in the current edition of The New Yorker.
I haven't, to tell you the truth.
What he says in it is that there's a shift in the Bush administration strategy in Iraq and the Middle East, and that this is leading us closer to a confrontation with Iran. I mean, that's one of the things that he says in the article. But I wonder, like covering the White House, if you think that the White House is in fact moving closer to a military confrontation, you know, airstrikes against Iran.
It's really hard to say. And I think there are people in the White House who are advocating that. But if you look at the comments that Secretary Rice made, the United States is now willing to enter into discussions about Iraq with Iran and Syria. That's a toe in the water towards diplomacy. Secretary Rice certainly prevailed with the North Korea discussions over Vice President Cheney. I think there's always going to be someone in the White House, and I know there are people who advocate getting much tougher with Iran. Now, one of the problems the administration has is when somebody stands up there and says, we have no plans to attack Iran, then you think back, I always think back to General Tommy Franks, who stood before the press and on the record said, we don't have any plans to attack Iraq. We haven't currently any plans to attack Iraq, which we now know they did. So I think when you have that history, you have a much more cynical press corps and certainly a much more cynical public. And I think that's what they're dealing with now as well. But you've also got, you know, the president had some pretty tough language this year about Iran. And then you have the others walking that back. Then you have, you know, pushback, pullback. I think they want to saber rattle, but they know they don't really have all that many sabers left.
Something else that Hirsch says in the article is that these plans to possibly attack Iran are coming out of the vice president's office. Some reporters I've spoken to say that they think that Cheney has really been weakened by the problems that we've had in Iraq, that's taken away some of his power. Seymour Hirsch disagrees with that. I wonder what your impressions are about how much power Cheney has now in the White House.
From my vantage point, it seems diminished, and I judge that only by the North Korea. What happened with North Korea, that Rice really did seem to prevail there and want to reach out diplomatically more than the vice president did. The vice president, as you know, is very secretive, but look at him in the last couple of weeks. He was the one they sent to, maybe this is the perfect role for him, to muscle Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan. I mean, some of the comments he made, in fact, on ABC, to ABC's John Carl, about what was happening in Iraq, I mean, were rather extraordinary, that it was good news, that it showed things are working, that the Brits are pulling out of Basra. So he is still saying things that, in a way, get the administration in hot water, that get a skeptical American public to say, what is he thinking?
My guest is Martha Raddatz, ABC's chief White House correspondent. Her new book about the battle in Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martha Raddatz, chief White House correspondent for ABC News. Her new book, The Long Road Home, reconstructs the battle in Sadr City when American troops realized they faced a major insurgency in Iraq. The book also describes what it was like for the families back home when they got news that loved ones were killed or wounded in the battle. You know, Bob Woodruff and his wife Lee were recently on our program. And as I'm sure our listeners know, less than a month after he took over as anchor of the ABC Nightly News, he sustained a severe brain injury while covering Iraq because of an IED. And his cameraman, who's a good friend of yours, Doug Vogt, was seriously injured too. I know you're friends with Woodruff as well. You've made 12 trips to Iraq since the American invasion. How did it affect you as a reporter to have two colleagues who are also good friends so seriously injured by an IED while reporting from Iraq?
Bob, Lee, and Doug are all good friends, and that was devastating. And it actually came in the middle of writing about the soldiers over there and the families and how they were affected. And for me, getting a call in the middle of the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning from Baghdad, telling me that Bob and Doug had been injured, I felt the same sickness I'm sure these families feel. That morning, I went into work, actually, and reported on Bob and Doug's attack. But before that, I called my daughter, and who was living in California at the time, and hearing how upset she was, because I knew, because she'd met Bob too, and hearing her and knowing that she knew it could have been any of us was very painful. But I keep going back. I think about it, we all think about it, but we also think it's an incredibly important story to cover. My family has been supportive. My daughter, who is now 26 and up in law school in New York, talks about it, but she knows. I go through this as a mom, too, that I think if something happened to me, people would be highly critical, that I did this with two kids.
How old's your other child?
My son is 15. Not quite as talkative about it as you might imagine. I think kids have the most amazing coping mechanisms, and Jake had always teased me. No matter what great things happened to me at work, he wasn't going to give me any credit. He'd always just say, "Huh, so you're not the anchor, huh?" And we'd laugh. "So you're the White House correspondent. Ah, too bad. Not the anchor, huh?" So that morning when I told Jake about Bob, and remember we had lost Peter Jennings as well, and who Jake had met as well, and I told him about Bob, and he just looked at me and said, "You know what, Mom? I decided I don't think you should be an anchor anymore." And I thought it was so sweet. And it was his way of thinking, okay, if she's not an anchor, she won't get hurt. She won't die. And he talks about it. I mean, he very sweetly gave me for my birthday this year all these girly lotions and shampoos, which are very sweet. And he said on the card, "Hope this brightens your trips to Iraq."
So you're going to take them to Iraq?
Absolutely. It will brighten my trips to Iraq. So it was great. But my kids have also, for the last two Christmas Eves, we have gone to Bethesda Naval Hospital because I am a huge advocate for a fund called the Semperfi Fund, which helps wounded Marines. And it is fantastic. And I've been involved with that for years. And I, 3 years ago, went to visit wounded Marines on Christmas Eve. And I didn't take my family. I didn't take my kids because I didn't know whether it would be appropriate, first of all, and whether I don't want wounded Marines to feel like we're all coming to just stare at them. But I could see they had their families around. It was fine. And so I brought them the last 2 years. I think it was very difficult for my son because there were some very serious injuries. And I, as a friend of mine said, "So I guess your son won't be joining the Marine Corps, huh?" But it's been a great experience, I think, for them. And it also lets them know how much it means to me. So I know I want my children to grow up and find a passion for themselves and find something that they want to do. They might pay me back and scare me to death with whatever it is they're doing, but I think we all have to let go. To me, I have raised my children to be independent and happy, and I will support them in ways they've supported me.
Now, your husband, Tom Gelton, is a longtime NPR reporter who has been in many war zones, too, including Bosnia in the 90s, and he did some amazing reporting from there.
He sure did.
Were you ever in war zones at the same time?
Yes, we were. We were in Bosnia, and in fact, I'm trying to think what year this was. It was probably December of 94, and he was in Sarajevo, and I was in Tuzla, and we had a bunch of NPR people there, and I know that night we it was near Christmas, and we got a somehow found Tom somehow found a little Christmas tree, and I found with Leo de Lagula, the engineer, a chicken, and somehow I made eggnog as well. I don't know what we had, but we had some dinner, but not very often and very briefly.
Were you already married then, or a couple?
We were not married. And we were friends. And then we eventually got married. And Tom is a wonderful, wonderful stepfather to my children. And they adore him. It's a wonderful, it's worked out wonderfully.
So does that mean he understands when you're in a war zone because he's been there?
He does. I can't say he loves it, and he gets mad at me when I say that I know he's not thrilled about it. He said, but I'm always supportive. Yes, he's always supportive, but who would be thrilled with having your spouse over there? You just can't be thrilled. And he always accuses me, which is exactly right, of not telling him what I'm going to do until I get back, which is true. And I know on a couple of trips, it's like, you're not really going anywhere on this trip. And then I knew I was going to Ramadi and didn't tell him. Because I don't like to talk about it before I go either. I just...
Does it make you sometimes nervous to talk about it?
I don't want to talk about it. Basically, what I don't like is I don't like other people to be nervous. And it was kind of cute. One Marine patrol I was out on, and there were rocket and mortar attacks. And the Marine said, oh, you probably shouldn't tell your husband. I said, the problem is I'm on TV. He's going to see it on TV. I pretty much have to tell him everything. So... And there was the one trip, the last time I went to Ramadi, actually I went to Ramadi on this trip too, sort of unexpectedly. I didn't have it on the air until I got back. So that was good news. And, you know, so you're safe and sound and back, and that's good. But there is always that. I mean, there's always, I remember this from Bosnia, and it was the first time I started thinking about the families and the people who are in the war zones. And there was a Defense Department official who was killed on Mount Igman, and I didn't know him, but I'd met him, but his family lived in Washington, D.C. And I remember thinking, again, it's that thing about the time difference, that you could have been through the most horrible day, or died, or been hurt, and your family isn't even awake yet. And for some reason, that always struck me, and I think it was in August of 94. And I was in Washington, I wasn't in Bosnia at the time, and just thinking they were going out to breakfast, they were doing this, and their dad was dead, and they didn't know it. And I don't know why that has always haunted me, but it has. And it's that, and maybe that's part of me as a journalist. I just want to know everything when it's happening, and I'd want to know every detail. Some of these details, actually, that the women told me about their spouses and in this battle, and would you want to know how he died, and would you want to know the moment they, Gary Valesky, unzipped the body bags to say goodbye to these men? I'd want to know all of that. I think I'd want to know everything, but some of them didn't. Some of them don't want to know the details. Some of them want to know everything.
Martha Raddatz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Martha Raddatz is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News. Her new book about the battle in Sadr City is called The Long Road Home. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. died last night. He was an advisor to President Kennedy. Coming up, an interview in which he talked about the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is Fresh Air. Historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. died of a heart attack last night at the age of 89. His New York Times obituary describes him as the historian whose more than 20 books shaped discussions for two generations about America's past. Schlesinger was a special advisor to President Kennedy and wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Kennedy's presidency. I spoke with Schlesinger in 2002 on the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought us to the brink of nuclear war. The crisis began on October 16, 1962, when President Kennedy was informed that CIA aerial spy photos revealed Soviet missiles had been secretly moved into Cuba, missiles with a far enough range to strike the United States. For the next 13 days, we moved closer to confrontation until the Soviets agreed to withdraw the missiles. When I spoke with Schlesinger, I asked about recently declassified documents pertaining to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Arthur Schlesinger, you were advising President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm going to ask you if you could choose one of the documents that was recently declassified and tell us if there's something that you learned that even you didn't know at the time.
I think the role of Cuba deserves a certain amount of emphasis, particularly because the meeting took place in Havana. And Fidel Castro is the only man, chief of state, who's still involved in the crisis, who is still around. Castro did not want to accept the missiles. He felt that this would make Cuba a strategic target. It would complicate Cuba's relationship with other countries in the Western Hemisphere. He would welcome Soviet troops. He would even welcome membership in the Warsaw Pact. But he didn't want the missiles. As Khrushchev put it in his own memoirs, we argued and argued, and finally Fidel gave in. Castro then proposed that the transaction be made public. There is no reason under international law why the Soviet Union should not send nuclear missiles to Cuba. However, Khrushchev believed in secrecy. He sent emissaries, sent messages, lying messages, denying that the Soviet Union was sending offensive missiles, offensive arms to Cuba. And the stealth and deceit which accompanied the Soviet deployment of missiles in Cuba gave a moral advantage to the United States.
Did you not realize at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis that Cuba didn't want those missiles?
We did not realize that. We assumed that Castro welcomed the missiles as a means of deterring the U.S. invasion. This recent conference gave much greater emphasis than the previous conference and the previous understanding to the real tension, the friction between Cuba and the Soviet Union. In fact, Castro seemed madder at Khrushchev than he seemed mad at Kennedy. Having accepted the missiles on the terms of socialist solidarity, he was appalled that Khrushchev had neglected to inform him of the withdrawal of the missiles. Castro himself heard that over the radio. And having made this great sacrifice because of the Russian avowals of the solidarity of the socialist bloc, the solidarity did not extend to consultation or even notification of the withdrawal of the missiles. He was furious.
How afraid were you during the Cuban Missile Crisis? And I'm wondering if you and other members of the Kennedy administration were telling their families to leave town? Were you telling your families at all anything that was happening behind the scenes? Were you sharing your fears once you realized how frightening the scenario was?
We were receiving evacuation notices, those of members of the White House staff, for example. But I think the general feeling was expressed by Robert Kennedy when he said that he was damned if he was going to abandon his wife and children, and that he would confront any crisis with his family. I think that's the way most of us felt.
So you were being advised to evacuate Washington and leave your families behind?
No, in case of war. We had evacuation instructions where to go.
To go to a safe place so that you could keep planning.
As they now say, a safe, undisclosed location.
Right. How close do you think we came to nuclear war? And is there one thing that you could put your finger on that you would isolate as having averted nuclear war?
I think the one thing that averted nuclear war was the understanding on the part of Khrushchev that he would lose the war. He was not a leader. He was a gambler, a plunger, but he didn't want to commit suicide. So I think looking back, he was bound to withdraw the missiles. We did not know at the time how clearly he saw the situation. But I think the great fear on Kennedy's part, and probably on Khrushchev's part too, also, was not that either country, either of these great powers, would deliberately initiate nuclear war, but it was that something would go badly wrong down the line somewhere. The Dr. Strangelove situation, where the crazy general decided on his own to launch a missile, and so on. It was that, where the issues of command and control were very much in Kennedy's mind, and in Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's mind, too.
Arthur Schlesinger recorded in 2002 on the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He died yesterday at the age of 89. If you want to catch up on things you missed on Fresh Air, you can now download podcasts of our shows on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five recorded The Message 25 years ago. This month, they'll be the first hip-hop act inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Flash and Melly Mel, who raps on The Message, and we'll hear from 2007 inductee Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. Join us for the next Fresh Air.